I'm Casper Dogovins at Dogman, listening to Sixth Sense Podcast.
What's up, Sense fans? You're listening to the Sixth Sense Podcast. Joined in the studios at CKCU by Francois and Tim. Gentlemen, how are you?
Excited to be here.
I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah.
You guys been enjoying the 2011 World Championship?
I actually watched the Canada-Russia game, or the first like two periods of that game the other day. I thought Spezza was looking fantastic. Beautiful goal on the breakaway.
Yeah.
Encouraging.
Before I forget, what are your thoughts on homosexuality in the NHL?
Well, we'll be discussing that after the break when I go on a rant about the death penalty, homosexuals in the army, and who I voted for a few weeks ago.
I just have like, visions of when Bobby Valentine came out and said that it was time in baseball to like embrace homosexual player, and then like the rumor mill started. Mike Piazza, and it was like right at that time where Mike Piazza had like the bleached blonde hair and like the pencil thin like handlebar mustache. And like he had that press conference where he totally had a meltdown. He's just like, I'm not gay. I date Playboy models, you know, blah, blah, et cetera. Just like total clusterfuck, right? Amazing. If Bobby Valentine, remember when he came out with that fucking disguise in the, he got tossed out of a game. He put on a fake mustache and and a player t-shirt and came back into the dugout.
Did you guys see Kyle Loesch come out dressed up as Tony La Russa the other
night? Yeah, that was fantastic.
But, you know, looking at Mike Piazza
there. Was he able to walk one foot in front of the other straight?
Piazza just should have leaked a sex tape, you know? That would have been the easiest thing. And, you know, looking back on it, the dyed hair, that's one thing. But Brett Boone, there is the worst frosted tips in the history of baseball. He never had those accusations.
Yunel Escobar might give him runs, but that reggaeton Latino flavor, so it's okay, right?
Well, A-Rod circa 2004.
Oh, yeah. That was bad, too.
Oh, those were fancy.
were those before or after Madonna?
I don't remember.
This is the greatest intro ever, and it has nothing to do with the Sense.
All I'm thinking about is Mariah Carey and Derek Jeter.
Oh.
I would love to see an interaction back then with the Yankees with Don Zimmer. Meeting Mariah Carey, shaking hands, exchanging pleasantries. Like, how does that conversation even go?
Maybe she grabbed his head like Pedro and tossed him down to the ground.
Yeah, well, she got aggressive in that video of Jay-Z, right? Remember that one?
Heartbreaker?
Yeah, with throwing popcorn and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Real hothead. So back to the World Championships. There's some people on Twitter asking us if we knew any similarities between the Jason Spezza and the World Championships and Jason Spezza that we saw on the Senators over the last 20 games. Thought that was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had nothing but positive things to say about Spezza all year, and I think that, you know,
over the last, I'd even extend it beyond that, going back like even two and a half, three seasons, we've been kind of
the progression.
Even like the mainstream media, I think, has come around full circle as well. But mind you, I think it helps that he's one of the few recognizable faces on a roster comprised of mostly AHL.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really come under the microscope, too, as we come close to the draft because, you know, the attention isn't, you know, so forced on acquiring a number one center this year because, lo and behold, according to the news, we already have one.
Have you seen that commercial, Spezza, in the Soho apartment condo?
Yeah, I want one of those apartments because all you do is meet chicks in the hot tub, sleep with them, and then Spezza comes and hangs out the next day.
And the guy behind the front desk walks your dog.
Yeah.
That sounds like a Carey Price type deal.
So here's my complaint with these Soho condos in Ottawa. It was my understanding that Soho refers to south of Houston Street, a New York and London thing. There's no Houston Street in Ottawa.
Yeah, I know. There's all these condo buildings with the fancy names. What's the other one? Tribeca? You know, that's like New York or whatever, too. Hey, we're turning into a cosmopolitan metropolis, guys.
We're so geographically aware.
Yeah.
A lot of New York talk, too.
Watch out for the gold trim on those hockey jerseys coming right up to cater to the demographics.
I'll have to start yelling a lot more about Jersey bastards and things like that.
Getting back to like hockey talk for this past... I had to bring the wagon full circle here.
Yeah, yeah.
Getting back to like the stuff that's gone down this week in the hockey world, we've had a hockey agent come out and use his company's Twitter account to denounce gay marriage. We've had Matthew Barnaby arrested for domestic assault. And we've had the death of Derek Boogaard. It's been kind of a crazy week.
Yeah, the movie's
eventful, for sure.
Where would you guys like to start?
Let's talk about this. We have to wait for the coroner's report on Derek Bogart, who has recently given his body to science, I believe, right? Or gave it to University
yeah,
Medical
donating,
School.
He's donating his brain to have it examined, and well, at least pertaining for concussion-related injuries, which is a great step. He's not the first hockey player. I'm sure he won't be the last to donate his body to science in that form.
No, it's incredibly important to do so. And but to stray away from the ease it would be to jump to conclusions about the nature of his death, the facts that we do know are, according to Larry Brooks
yep.
of the Post, New York Post, said he had recently entered the NHL substance abuse program. So perhaps there's one factor right there.
Yeah, everybody's jumping to conclusions, though. Like, as soon as the injury or his death happened, you know, your first inclination is to think, oh, well, I wonder if it had to do with his concussions. And, like, Ottawa's own Matt Carter was the one who knocked him out in his last fight. You don't want to ever lump in such a generality and say that was a contributing causal factor in his untimely death. But now it's a bunch of other contributing factors, like possibly substance abuse, whether it was alcohol, drugs, whatever. It's just, it's sad because the general consensus opinion on Derek Bogart is he was such a great guy.
Yep. Well, these things are going to enter the conversation one way or the another, just the way the world works these days. News has to be instant. We have to have instant explanation and analysis, and no one's willing to wait a few days to find out what medicine has to say about all this. But maybe it is important if the NHL can address the serious impacts of these massive guys. Like, Bogart was a monster out there, and Matt Carkner, also a monster. And these guys are throwing punches, and the fact that you can even... People are even beginning to suggest that we need to have a conversation about concussion from a planned, you know, premeditated fight, basically, right, between these two enforcers could in any way lead to the death of an individual. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff right there. That's a first step, early warning sign kind of material.
And the other thing is not to trivialize the death of Derek Bogart, but I think once the coroner's report comes back, depending on what might or might not be in there, it'll be really interesting to see moving forward how the NHL deals with this. And I'm not jumping to conclusions. Let's imagine that the coroner's report comes back and there is evidence that Derek Bogart was taking performance-enhancing drugs. You know, how it'll be interesting to see how the NHL deals with this, because I personally think the NHL has made an absolute, you know, has been abominable in the way it's dealt with most serious issues that should be addressed with improving the game. So it's unfortunate that, like, a tragic situation such as the death of Derek Bogart might be a springboard for the NHL having to right itself, whether it's with mandatory drug testing like the NFL and other things. I mean, it'll be kind of interesting to follow this. It'd be an interesting subplot to look at, I think.
Well, I'd even extend that to if it was alcohol related or whatever, like looking at the professional sports as a whole and in totality, like, there's so many deaths in the last number of years that pertain to, like, DUIs. Who's, like, Sin Chu Chu was, like, the most recent example in baseball.
Derek Lowe, Miguel Cabrera.
There's a systemic problem in professional sports where athletes feel like they're entitled.
And it's funny because, you know, there's always this unspoken kind of understanding in hockey that alcohol is kind of part of the sport, you know, at the recreational level. It's always, you know, beers after the game, like trunk beers, beers in the locker room, spraying beers or champagne or whatever. But there's a real culture of drinking that's kind of, you know, unspokenly lingers in the air around hockey. I don't know. I can't speak on about professional hockey, but all of us have been to bars in Ottawa. We've all seen a couple hockey players there, whether or not they've been having a beer or not. It's not the point. But it does kind of linger. And Yahoo Sports actually had a great article about Nick Adenhart, the Angels pitcher, who was killed by a drunk driver, 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. And how it's so irresponsible for Major League Baseball to continue to employ these guys like Derek Lowe and Cabrera and Chu when they just finished having memorials for Nick Adenhart. And it is kind of disgusting.
And just to follow on what you're saying, Tim, you're absolutely right. It's hard to sort of say, because everyone's allowed to have a good time, you know what I mean? Like, I haven't been opposed to having the odd drink myself, the odd time, you know what I mean? But I think that in the case of professional athletes, they might get this false sense of invincibility. You know, they're put on the pedestal by millions and millions of fans. So everything that comes around with that, you know, maybe some of these guys, they need to put things back in perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of everything related to substance abuse and things like that.
Are girls taking pictures of you after you spend the night at their place with their phone and then uploading it to the internet for everyone to see?
Yeah.
Did you see that with Patrick Kane?
No, but there's tons of those websites too, right? Like, it's just, these guys got, I mean, they have to be careful. I mean, they have to manage their own brand and stuff like that. And I think that's why guys like, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but guys like Sidney Crosby, who, it's good to have some of these guys still have that reputation of sort of being that sort of understated.
But that's tireless work, right? Like, there's been interviews with Sidney where he's actually conceded that, yeah, it's tireless being that guy because you're the icon for the league, right? You're the figurehead.
Yeah.
Well, he's well compensated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One more little New York slice here. I'm in the middle of David Wells' book a few years past the date, and he tells a story about how in New York there are actually people, women, who will drug the baseball players in a bar when they're hitting on them, take them back to the hotel room while they're still semi-conscious, they pass out, then the woman will immediately call a man, and the man will come over undressed next to the passed out baseball player who has since been undressed by the woman, and the woman will take photographs and create these, you know, these photos that would imply that the baseball player is a homosexual, and then blackmail them. And David Wells actually goes on the record as saying that this happened to people on the New York Yankees when he was there, and in only one situation were the proper steps taken with the police. Every other time it was buried by the player agreeing to the blackmail costs.
Wow. Did you get to the point yet where, because has David Wells not admitted that he was either still slightly intoxicated or badly hungover when he pitched his perfect game?
Just finished it last night. Yes, on a Saturday night I was reading some David Wells, but yeah, he was... He talked about how wasted he was at the very beginning. He kind of overblows it. I don't think he was actually drunk.
He's always been sort of one of those like folkloric type characters. You know what I mean? Like the sort of the trailer park guy. I mean, his jersey just used to look like a big garbage bag on him and stuff like that. Like, but he's always had sort of like that persona that extends far beyond the David Wells. You know what I mean?
Well, he was saying that he was at the Saturday Night Live after party, like the year end party. And the show ends, what, at 1 o'clock? And he says he was home by 5. Like, that's only 4 hours worth of drinking. I mean, he's a big guy. I mean, that's not a lot of time. And he had to go throw an afternoon game. How bad could it have actually been, right? Like,
boomer.
You know, I don't think those were Wade Boggs-type beers he was drinking. That's for sure.
But so have you guys been watching any of the playoff?
Canucks series was boring against the Predators.
I can't wait for Tampa Bay to get booted so we can stop hearing, like,
Steve Yzerman built the whole team or whatever.
Oh, God.
You know what, though? Like, I have to say, I've sort of flipped back and forth between the NHL and NBA playoffs. I'm actually very interested in the NBA playoffs this year, especially to see the Kobe Bryant era come to an end and not a moment too soon in that massive meltdown in Dallas. But the one there's two things that really stuck out to me in these playoffs. The first thing is Martin St. Louis is outstanding. He is... I don't want to use the word underrated because I think he is acknowledged to be a good player in the NHL, but he is just outstanding. And the other thing is, I think the debate between, say, who the best player in the game is, it's gone. The argument's been or it's either Crosby or Ovechkin. I have to tell you something, and it's not because he's also Russian that whatever, but I think that debate is between Crosby and Datsyuk now. Like, Datsyuk is just phenomenal. Better all-around player.
The one thing, the defining moment of that whole Washington-Tampa series was Hedman touching Ovechkin on the helmet after Ovechkin had that end-to-end rush in the final game. And Ovechkin looked like he was the only guy on the ice who gave a shit what was happening out there on the ice. Like, he never gave up.
I thought Semin really brought his A-game once again.
But, I don't know.
Now all the Sens fans think we can get Semin on the cheap.
Washington's probably, I think they're a couple years away from being the elite team in the East, only because I think it's going to take that amount of time for Johansson to develop into that quality second-line center that I think he will grow into. But they're kind of where Ottawa was, right? They had that one top line in the Stanley Cup Finals, and there wasn't a lot of secondary scoring behind it. And if Semin isn't going, Ovechkin's not going to be able to do it himself, especially when Backstrom's struggling. You look at Brooks Like, and he's not a second line center guy either. It's like that Mike Fisher problem that we had here in town.
Yeah, and as good as Mike Green was in the first round, he totally disappeared in the second round.
Exactly. And I think if you look at that team and you possibly parlay guys like Semin and Green into better, maybe more depth is what they need. and surround that with some guys who can actually put the puck in the net consistently, they'll be better for it.
But I also get the impression with Washington that like the window is fast closing for them too.
Yeah, but they have a deep prospect system too, right? It's not like Ottawa where the cupboard was bare because John Mockler had empty the coffers, right?
That's a good point. And, I mean, it could be worse. Sergei Bobrovsky could be their goaltender.
And they have core guys locked in for long periods of time, right? I mean, you know, at that point, you can essentially go the Pittsburgh route and just start mix and matching your accessory players.
But at some point in time, there comes a point in time where they have to make a trade to put them over the top. And it's the same situation that you've seen with LA, right? Like, they've hoarded so many draft picks who the odds of them all panning out, it's not going to happen. But they've held on to some of their prospects so long that they've devalued, and they're not going to be able to get as much for them as what they could have. And I look at a team like LA, and I think, wow, that window's probably closing faster than it should.
Yeah, like Colton Tupert, I mean, his stock has really fallen over the past few years.
Thomas Hickey.
Like, these guys have been playing in the AHL forever.
Oscar Mahler.
Yeah, like, you know, like...
Voinov is another one.
Like, you wonder if it's better to get rid of these guys when their exposure to other professionals is lower when they're still, you know, playing competent minutes in the juniors.
Well, it's like Nick Foligno too, right? Like, a lot of people view that guy as a potential top six guy. I don't see it.
No.
That's a guy I'd probably sell
not
high.
Not in this organization.
No hands. No hands.
Nah.
No finish.
That's the thing. Like, personally, looking at this offseason, if we had to pen a game plan, I look at Foligno as the guy that you probably want to package with maybe a first round pick to move up in the draft, or maybe you want to like trade those picks to get a guy like Kyle Turris in here and another young center who's further along in his development than whomever we would be drafting this year, in the first round.
Exactly, because I think a guy like Foligno is a guy who around the league probably still has that reputation of, like you say, people probably think that he can fit into a top six role,
like
given
love his
the
dad.
Right situation or whatever. But yeah. Like the thing is that reputation is not going to go on forever.
Well, it's almost like, Mike Fisher, we've talked about that endlessly on the show before. And he's another guy whose reputation preceded him. And look at Thomas Caberle in Boston right now. Like, that guy's a bag of shit.
But look what Mike Fisher did in Nashville, though, in the playoffs. I mean, you can't, after watching that series, you can't really argue that that was a bad deal for Nashville.
No, it was a good deal for Nashville. Is he really, truly a number two center? Probably not. But on a team like Nashville, he is a nice fit. You know what I mean? Like, the thing is, the way Nashville's built with four very even scoring lines and they're heavy on the defense. Ottawa was sort of, the prototypical way that you build a contender, at least I think, is you have those two really talented forward lines, and then you fill out the third and fourth line with guys who are good skaters,
guys
and
draft
players,
guys you draft in the
exactly, yeah, on the cheap. So I think like, and because of Mike Fisher's contract, like teams are forced to put him in that top six role, but that's really not the nature of his game, you know. But he fits in well with Nashville because it's essentially a team up front anyways full of Mike Fisher type players. So
well, if the salary is the concern here in all of this, then I think the money's going to be coming back to them twofold when they start seeing season ticket renewals and brand new season tickets, inaugural ticket purchases start coming through the gates this year. There's been so many articles written about what a fantastic success these playoffs has been for the Predators in the business side of things. So I think that they will get their money's worth with him, and he'll continue to disappoint between being an overpaid third liner and underperforming second liner.
I mean, I don't really see Nashville ever getting much better than they are, because I think in the playoffs, like I'm a firm believer in the fact that ultimately in a seven-game series, the team with the best players win. Or what I mean by best players is the team with those star players who can dictate the pace of a game win. We see a perfect example of that in basketball with the Miami Heat, right? You're not going to be able to shut down Dwayne Wade and LeBron James for 4 out of 7 games in the series. It's not going to happen. And so you saw it with the Pittsburgh Penguins when they won the Stanley Cup, right? Like Malkin and Crosby are the two best players on the ice. So Nashville doesn't really have that, right? Like aside from Shea Weber, I mean, up top, not much.
Legwand, huh?
They might be better off next year. I think Radulov, there's a rumor that Radulov might come back from the KHL. And that guy's a fantastic hockey player.
But is he a fantastic hockey player in the playoffs?
Remains to be seen. Remains to be seen.
One thing I liked from this from watching the playoffs is I was tuning into one of the games on Versus when I was watching the Red Wings and the Sharks in Game 7. And I think one of the reasons that hockey could, you know, really grow a lot in the States is by getting some quality announcers who know what they're talking about. The guy had the audacity to compare Datsyuk to David Krejci when he was talking about the similarities between Boston and Detroit. Yeah, yeah, you're rolling your eyes here, and it's true. He's going on, you know, and blah, blah, blah. They've got, you know, Holmstrom's the equivalent of Luchik, and it's just atrocious. It's like saying Tiger Woods is the same as Kevin Hayem. Like,
well, Kevin Hayem might tell you that.
All right, so we've been kind of talking long enough. A couple of weeks ago, we promised our listeners that we'd at least take a long look at the NHL draft and bring in some people, some reputable names who could come on and provide us with some educated opinions as to the prospects available for this draft. So joining us on the line when we get back will be Sam Cosentino from Rogers Sportsnet. Right after that, we're going to be back with Gus Katsaros from McKean's. And
yeah, we got Joey Keithley. He's the Canadian Sid Vicious, big hockey fan.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Joining us on the line right now is Sam Cosentino from Rogers Sports. Sam, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, nice to be on the show. I'm glad we finally got our paths all straightened out. Good to be on. Thanks.
That's a busy time of year for everyone. All right, so Sam, one of your areas of interest is the CHL. Of course, we have the draft coming up, but one of the few things we've had to look forward to in Senators land over the past few months. Maybe you can give us a quick general assessment of the 2011 entry draft.
Yeah, I like it. And my my impression from the scouts is they find it's a deep draft. You look at about the top 10 or 15 guys in round number one, and then it starts to take a bit of a downturn. But in terms of the overall draft depth for 2011, most all the scouts I've talked to are really looking forward to this one.
How would you compare this draft to previous years?
It really, for me, it starts at the top. You don't have that Taylor Hall, that Steven Stamkos or John Tavares, who's the surefire number one guy. There is a lot of conjecture over who that number one player is going to be. And if we spoke at this time last year, I think Sean Couturier would have been the consensus guy. And now I think he's kind of slipped down a little bit. Gabriel Landeskog is the guy I've touted as being the number one pick, just because I think he's the most National Hockey League ready. But having said that, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins will be in the mix. Jonathan Huberdeau, if he and the St. John Sea Dogs can get through to the MasterCard Memorial Cup, and I think he's going to have a say in terms of maybe being a guy who kind of sneaky peats his way into that top one or two spots. So what I really like about this draft is that it doesn't have that clear-cut number one guy. So I think it has drawn a lot of interest, not just from people who are generally interested in hockey, but from teams in particular to see what direction they're going to go, especially the teams picking in the top five.
How big a blow was it to the Ottawa Senators to fall from five to number six in this draft? Do you think that's going to hurt their draft position or put them out of the running to get the guy that they really want?
Yeah, well, you can look at it that way, but I think you can look at it in another way, too, and feel that when you have that pick, plus I think 10 more in this draft altogether, Brian Murray's going to have the opportunity that if he really feels strongly about one of the aforementioned players, that, you know, maybe he could package that with a second or a third and move up a couple of spots, and if he really covets a particular player. But having said that, to sit in the sixth hole is pretty good because, you know, with some of the draft predictions and some of the people that I've been talking to recently, maybe that's where a guy like Sean Couturier slips down to. And boy, if you can get a guy like him at number six, you're going to be in really good shape.
Now, you're talking about Sean Couturier, and that's one of the questions I had planned to ask you, but why do you think he's fallen out of favor compared to this time last year?
Yeah, I don't know if it's fallen out of favor. I think what happens is when you get late birthdays, and I use Taylor Hall as a perfect example, you get guys who, they get seen too much. It's almost like they're overexposed, and after a while, scouts really start to find holes in their games because they've seen them so much, as opposed to continually praising all the good things they do. And I think Couturier has been part and parcel of that. But it's not a discredit to Couturier, but I also think it's been the rise in prominence and the development of the players who are now seemingly ahead of him. So it's a bit of a combination of both. Being seen probably too much because he's a late birthday, but also having the opportunity where other players step up and develop over the course of a year.
One of the things that we've been talking about over the course of the past few weeks has been how Ottawa plugged the hole with Craig Anderson in Nets and how that kind of
pushed Ottawa from the second last position in the standings to where they're sitting now. And like Tim and I have been having the discussion whether or not the prospects at 5-6 might be significantly worse than maybe one of the top two guys who end up going. What's your evaluation of maybe a guy like a Landeskog as opposed to maybe someone who's at that 5 or 6 slot? Is there a huge gap in talent there?
No, for me, the big difference when it comes to Landeskog in particular, I think he's ready to step in and play right now. He's got man strength, kind of a man build, and he thinks the game well. And I think when you look at players that come into the league as 18-year-old players, the one thing you have to be concerned of is how the physical grind is going to affect them. And that's why I think Landeskog is the most able, ready guy to step right in. Now, having said that, the guy probably with the most upside and most potential projecting three years down the road is probably Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. And so are you going to take a guy that you think that you need to get into the lineup right away, like maybe an Adam Larson is also that type of player? Or are you going to take a guy where you know you have a little time to develop some players and you know there's not immediate pressure for your 18-year-old to have an impact, so you maybe pick a guy who's projected, like a Doug Hamilton, for example, who I think probably won't play next year, but will have the opportunity to step in maybe as a 20-year-old and start to give you some minutes. So that's kind of how I see things. It just so much depends on, all right, are you going to draft the best available athlete, which teams tend to do? Are you going to draft the guy which you need to step right in? Or are you going to draft for position? And when you take all those three factors in consideration, I'm not exactly sure where Brian Murray and Tim Murray sit in that regard, but if you address all of those things, depending on who's available when you get your choice, either looking for a future a little bit down the road or you're looking for someone to have an immediate impact.
No, I think that's absolutely bang on. It just seems like a great draft year for the fans to salivate and try to project who's going to fall where, because ultimately I'm sure we're all going to be quite surprised when it actually goes down. But one thing I got to ask you is, how much stock do you put in to these draft-eligible kids going deep into the playoffs, like we're seeing with Jonathan Huberdeau right now playing against Gatineau, or even the performance of players late in the season at the U18 championships? How important is that for these players compared to a guy like Ryan Strome, who maybe didn't have the best playoffs?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think those events are really important. But when you get to the top guys, the first, I would say, probably three rounds, scouts will have had enough looks at those guys to make a determination as to where they're going to slot them on their respective teams' draft boards. But when you look at the under-18s, the ability to go not only play against top competition, not only play on a different ice surface, but to be able to play with top players, and that seemingly can make guys better as well, but it also can show that you have the ability to do that and make that, you know, subtle jump as an 18-year-old to the under-18s or deep into the respective Canadian Hockey League playoffs. So under-18s, yeah, definitely huge. And I think going deep into the playoffs, what it shows is your will to win, your physical strength, if you can handle the long grind of a season that takes you through, you know, higher-end players will play in some special events, Subway Super Series, they'll go to prospector development camps and that sort of thing. So when you lengthen out the season in that regard, it gives scouts a kind of an indication of how ready these guys are physically. And I think the other thing is, hey, when the going gets tough, when the playoffs, teams become harder to play against, minutes are shrunk for certain guys, that really shows kind of the true measure, not only of skill and talent, but character as well. And I think character is something that over the last probably 8 or 10 years in this draft has really come to the fore. So there's no doubt those things are important. But for guys who, like Ryan Strome, really didn't have, especially this third round wasn't particularly good, but I thought he was pretty awesome before that, scouts will have had enough looks at a guy like Strome to be able to make a determination as to where they're going to slot him on the board.
Oh, it sounds familiar. It sounds like the World Junior Championships where you hear some of the guys saying, well, you know, you can't really hurt your draft stock there. You can only improve it.
Yeah, I think there are certain times when you look at a player, and I think it's a lot of times how they react to adversity, and that's where that kind of thing comes to the fore in the playoffs. So can a guy really hurt himself? Well, he's been seen enough, but maybe a guy who doesn't react well to adversity, takes a bad penalty, continuously is taking bad penalties or being undisciplined when his time needs the most. Maybe a guy who you have slotted – in the top 10 all of a sudden slips to a 12, a 13, a 15 on your draft board because of that. But you're right. I wouldn't say there's going to be any drastic changes as a result of guys playing in maybe the under-18s or going deep into the Canadian Hockey League playoffs.
Once Vancouver beat Nashville, I believe it solidified Ottawa's draft position with the 21st selection. We've looked at a couple of projected draft board scenarios, and is there anyone who catches your eye who might be available in that range, or is there a player on the draft board who you would possibly consider trading up for to get?
Yeah, that's a really, I mean, 6 and 21, that's two good picks. I mean, you could, I don't think you'd definitely want to keep one of those, but the 21st would be probably a perfect pick to package along with a third rounder, maybe to bump up and get into that top 10. I think that would be a pretty good scenario. But when I look at players that in that 21 range, boy, there's Xavier Ouellette, defenseman out of the Montreal Juniors, comes to mind. Really good competitor, hard worker, great will to win. A guy like Philip Deneau plays in Victoriaville, I think is just going to be a fantastic player. Has great leadership skills, represented the country at the under-18s, as an 18-year-old was voted for his team in Victorial as the captain there, including a team that had a lot of 19- and 20-year-olds. So I think that speaks volumes to his leadership ability. But, off the top of my head, those are two guys that I can think of immediately. And then my guess is that, if Brian Murray is really making to make an impact with this draft, that pick may, who knows, maybe it gets moved and packaged and they get it into two picks in the top 10 or 15. And I could definitely see something like that happen.
One of the guys who I thought might be a decent fit if Ottawa did end up trading that second first-rounder was to maybe move into the top 10 and grab another physical defenseman like a Duncan Siemens. What are your thoughts on Siemens?
I like Siemens. I think he's been a little overrated. I think that, and for me, just having watched him play in my own thoughts, probably his offensive game, I think, has been a little overrated to this point. But tough as nails, huge will to win, unbelievable competitor. He's got that nice edge between being, arrogant and being humble. He kind of sits right on the border there. Well, every now and then he'll slip into that arrogance thing. And I think that's good for young players to have that. I like his size. I like his awareness. I like the fact that on a really deep defensive core in Saskatoon, he was able to kind of step in and also provide some offense this year, which that part of his game hasn't been quite as good. But I think he's still a little overrated in that area. But tough, physical, mean, fights. Yeah, he's a guy that probably fits right into that range for sure.
Are there any guys that you see on the draft board this year that maybe have some red flags, similar to the way Jared Cowan fell to the Senators at number 9 coming off the leg injury? There's the forward, the name's evading me right now. Matt
Pumple, yeah.
Yeah, from Peterborough. Yeah. Are there any guys that could end up being a real gem in the late first round, second round, who are coming off an injury or just having red flags surrounding them?
No, I don't. Pumple is the one guy who I think when you go back to last year was a surefire top 10 guy. Now, Peterborough, didn't get off to the kind of start and eventually didn't have the type of season that they were expecting to have, having gone younger, having made a couple of trades. But he'd be the guy that immediately comes to mind in terms of injury. But you know what? Scouts, they have a good indication. I use Brett Connolly as a perfect example. You talk about Jared Cowan as another example. Brett Connolly, to me, is a guy who missed a ton of time. Joey Hischen missed a ton of time, ends up going 17th overall last year. So by this time, scouts have had a read on those types of guys. When it comes to Pumple in particular, yeah, there were times when I there were probably people who thought that maybe his game wasn't quite developed along the path that they would have seen it by the way he played last year, being the Canadian Hockey League Rookie of the Year. But, the injury shut down his season early. He's going to be a guy that draws huge interest for me to see where he goes because of the injury, because he didn't have quite the year he had as a rookie. He's going to be one guy that I'll be keeping my eye on for sure.
All right, Sam, we know you have to get going shortly because of the game this afternoon. I just wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on the Jays thus far? I know you're a big baseball fan.
Yeah, the Jays, not much a part of my program with Sportsnet anymore. I kind of got to removed out of that role, so it's I've been following it, but kind of following it from afar. And I think I'm a big Alex Anthopoulos fan. I think he's doing good things. I think Jays fans are going to have to be patient. Pretty good run right now, but it remains to be seen. I think when you talk about teams developing and putting a timestamp on a year when they want to arrive. People think the playoffs are going to expand by a team next year. That, you know, those things come to mind. But for me, it's so tough to extrapolate in baseball, especially with young pitching. And the Blue Jays are finding that out now. You know, Brett Cecil, Morrow shut down for a little bit of time to start the year. You really want your guys to come back and build on the years they've had previously, especially with how good the young staff was last year. Doesn't always work out that way in baseball, especially with young pitching. But, I like the job Alex has done. I like the path in which they're going, and I think good things are not too far in the distant future.
Last question for you. How did you feel about the Travis Snyder demotion to Las Vegas?
Probably necessary. I think he just needs to go down and get on a roll where he's confident and can do the things that everyone has seen him do. He had a really good run before he got hurt last year, about a 2 or 3 week stretch where he was hitting everything, hitting it hard and hitting it far. So I think he's a guy who can get back to that. I think getting down to AAA, the ball flies a little better, taking the pressure off, having to worry about your next at bat, knowing that you're going to be in the lineup and that kind of thing is going to be very helpful for him.
All right, Sam. Thanks a lot for joining us on this program. Hope you had a good time, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
All right, take care. Enjoy the game this afternoon.
Take it easy. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Bye.
Joining us on the line is Guts Caseros. He's the pro scout and coordinator for McKean's Hockey Prospect. Gus, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thanks a lot for the invitation, guys. I'm doing great.
Absolutely. Straight off the bat, maybe you can give us a quick assessment of the 2011 entry draft, what some of the themes of this draft are, maybe how it compares to, you know, previous year's drafts, just anything in general.
Well, I'll give you a more of a, without getting into specifics on players, you know, I think that fans have been really spoiled over the last few seasons, especially with some of the players that have been able to just kind of step into the NHL, guys like Taylor Hall, and obviously you got the Sids and the Ovechkins, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that what everybody has to keep in mind is that these are still kids. These are projects. They are players that are developing their game and developing their skills, mental attitude, physical abilities, you know, size, strength, et cetera. To be able to eventually step into the NHL. So when you look into the comparison of this year compared to maybe last season or even the draft before that, you may not see an immediate influx of talent just making your way right directly into the NHL. I think that there's going to be a little bit more seasoning, a little bit more development involved, maybe on a player-by-player basis, not necessarily in general. But you're still going to get, like, I mean, from the Ottawa Senators' perspective, you're still going to get a decent player at wherever they're picking, but they're going to have to put in resources. And I think that's the theme of this and last year's draft. There's a lot more involved in picking a player and making sure that they're able to play in the NHL rather than the season where, you know, like Steven Stamkos was able to step in, even a guy like Luke Shen for Toronto. You know, Nikita Filatov, who was supposed to be such a great prospect, is still yet to really make an impact in the NHL. So there's a bit of a hit and miss every season. This one, I think that you're going to see teams are going to be a little bit more involved in the development process rather than having players step right into their lineups.
I think there's like a single tear running down Tim's cheek. Yeah, he was hoping that we could get somebody who could step in right away and start playing. do you see a huge gap between the first few picks in the draft and, say, the 5 or 6 slot where Ottawa's drafting?
No, that, I don't really think that there's that much of a gap. I think that teams are going to be picking their specific to their own needs. There are very few players I can feel that would probably be able to step right in this year. That's not to say that, you see, the mentality, the perception is also a little bit different too. Just because a player is not able to step in this, you know, right after they're drafted, doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, they're not going to be able to. Sometimes it's just a matter of a team picking a player that may not necessarily fit with their particular plans moving forward. There could be other personnel, whatever the case is. And I feel that any player pretty much in the top 10 right now will probably end up back in junior, or at least in the case of maybe like a guy like Adam Larson, who doesn't have to go back to junior, would probably step into the AHL. They're going to need seasoning. They're going to need development. They're going to need individual and team resources in order to be able to become professional hockey players. And, you know, that I would make that more of the rule rather than the exception. Too many times we see players like Jeff Skinner last year especially come in, you know, late in the first top 10 and, you know, make such an impact. That's a rarity. That's not the rule. That's the rarity. And I think that people see that as the rule rather than the rarity, and that's where the perception kind of changes everything.
Gus, you mentioned that you thought the trend this year would be that teams would draft more based on positional need than, say, taking the best athlete or the best player on the board. And you think that's a reflection on, as you say, there's not a whole lot of sort of disparity among the talent. It's all fairly even, at least in the first half of the first round. And you think that drafting based on position, even though the skills are fairly widespread in the first round, do you think that's a good strategy, or, you know, would you still sort of draft the best player on the board?
To make a bit of a generality, I would say that most teams will end up playing the best taking the best player available, because if you step aside, or at least take a step back and see more or less what these players are, they're assets. Right, they're essentially just an asset within your organization. So even if you take that, let's just say that a team that is really, you know, like Nashville. Let's use Nashville as an example. For them to take a defenseman would seem like a waste, because they just keep, you know, pumping out these great, great defensemen in the Suitors and the Webbers and, you know, the Cody Franzens and Jonathan Blooms. However, if they did find themselves in a position where they're able to take a defenseman, knowing that at some point in time they could possibly even flip them, or knowing that they have such a good developmental structure within their own organizations that they're able to make this player into a valuable asset at some other point in time, perhaps even trading a current asset from their either minor league or major roster, I think that that's more the mindset. I'd like to take a step back from the general mentality view of what is available in the draft, and rather taking by on a player-by-player basis. Drafting by position is specific, I think, to, I don't know, like, let's say, maybe the first five picks, only because, you know, there's a little bit more of a high-end skill at that point. Some teams will recognize what their own particular needs are. Some teams are really desperate up front. Others are, you know, Ottawa's pretty good in terms of the talent that they've assembled on their blue line, so it would be a bit of a waste to add another defenseman, just using that as an example. However, if they're faced with the possibility of getting a much better player in a defenseman than they are in a forward, they might end up taking that chance, knowing that they'd be able to either flip that asset or a current asset on their own roster. You got to take what is best available for your organization, not the best player available or the best player available by position. You have to do what's best for your entire organization now and in the long term.
Now, how do you define best player available? Maybe it would help us and the listeners, because one of the biggest things I see thrown around on the internet and in the newspapers is this term best player available. But what are the traits that make up the best player available? What is it that the scouts are actually looking for in these 18-year-olds?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because, you know, even in the fantasy aspect of armchair GMs taking the quote-unquote best player available, well, you have to make a decision. And I think what you're looking at, as a scout is not looking for a home run. Not every player is going to be an Ovechkin. Not every player is going to be a Crosby. What they do is they have their own guidelines. And what we use as a guideline is McKean's looks as itself as the 31st team. We look for players with specific skills. So it's, you got speed, skill, smarts, skating. So you have those four S's of scouting, and you base a player's attributes on those particular skill sets. So what a scout is going to do is he's going to go out and he's going to find a player that he feels, according to their development structure, is the best player available for them to develop into an NHL player, meaning they have three of those four S's or two of those four S's, but a potential of developing a third, or a potential of having three with a potential of developing a fourth. They're looking for, and by best player, I mean the best available skill set for them to develop as quickly as possible into an NHLer. And that also includes the money aspect too, right? Because the longer it takes to develop, the more they're paying this boy, and the longer that they're going to have to keep dumping resources in to become a potential NHLer. So that's what I mean by best player available. I have a feeling, though, that that definition or that view is probably not as widely held amongst fans and others that don't really follow the amateur scouting game a little bit as close as we do. They'll probably think is the best player available is the most skilled player, and that's not necessarily the case. Sometimes skill does take a backseat to things like character and the ability to learn and how quick they're able to adapt to their new surroundings, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot that you can learn by just talking to the players and their coaches and their peers that is not necessarily evident in just watching games. So there's a very distinct definition of what players, what each organization deems as the best player available.
No, that's definitely good to get out on the table so everyone understands now.
I just had a quick question pertaining Ottawa's first draft pick at the sixth spot. Talking to the guys off air, it seems like one of the pressing needs for Ottawa is to develop a second-line center, or at least a top-six center in the next couple of years. Are there projectability issues with some of the guys who are slotted as centers early in this draft?
Well, I think that you have a good selection as far as where Ottawa is. You have a really good a potential to see that there's. I don't think that this draft is full of the high-end talent as in previous drafts, but you're going to get a guy like Sean Couturier, and I'm only just using that name as an example. I'm not saying that Ottawa's targeting him. But here's a player that has a lot of skill. Like, there's a lot of natural skill in his game. But he's pretty mature defensively as well. So from a scouting perspective, you might look at him and say, well, yeah, there are flaws. There are little warts in his game. But there are things that we can kind of iron out as he develops into a professional. And he does have that potential of being a second-line center with a good defensive mentality. And I think that what Ottawa is probably looking at is players like him and Ryan Strome and Jonathan Huberdeau, who are able to probably get into that Ottawa lineup, maybe in the 2 to 3 year range, that have a higher offensive skill set, regardless of where they're drafting, whether it's 2 or 6, but do have the skills that are able to translate well into the NHL. So I don't think that they're looking at specific, you know, scoring ability for a second line player. They're looking at the guys that. At their overall game and trying to see, do they fit what they want in terms of their definition of what a second-line center should be. Now, at the same time, even if that player doesn't necessarily project or hit that potential that they look for, sometimes you have to take the hit and say, well, you know what, even if he doesn't end up being a second-line center, he could potentially be a good third-line player. So they might be looking at all three of those guys that I just mentioned and saying, you know, maybe perhaps there is a spot for him on this team, and they'll make the decision based on whatever is available at 6 and take the best player available according to what I defined earlier.
I looked at ESPN the other day, and they actually project Gabriel Landeskog to slide down to 6, and of course, I'm sure Ottawa fans would think that's a very sexy proposition with all the parallels between Daniel Alfredson and whatnot. Do you foresee that as a realistic scenario, or do you think that Landeskog will be well off the board by the time the sixth pick comes?
Oh, I think he'll be well off the board. I mean, this guy is just a dynamic talent. I haven't watched Ryan Nugent-Hopkins as much as I probably should have, but I've seen a lot of Gabriel Landeskog, and, you know, even as a 17-year-old last year, he was just visible every single shift. There's things that he does that are just above and beyond the maturity of an 18-year-old, and he's... He also developed. He has this background character that it translates so well. So any team that would take him, whether it's number 1, 2, 3, you know, if he does fall to 6, then I think Ottawa should be, you know, happier than a pig in slop, because that would be a phenomenal drop on the first part and a phenomenal pickup on the second part. I just don't think that he'll be available when Ottawa's drafting.
Oh, Gus, there's been a lot of attention given to the high-end CHL players in this coming draft, as well as some of the Europeans like Adam Larsson and Landeskog, who we were just talking about. But what can you tell us about some of the other high-end Europeans currently playing on European soil, or even some of the NCAA or U.S. development players who should be on the radar as well?
My focus really is more on the CHL, so I don't watch as much NCAA or Europe. Having said that, I feel that those players are pretty much on par with anything that's available here in the Canadian Hockey League. I don't feel that there's any hidden talent or any, you know, gems that, you know, hidden gems that you're going to find out in Europe or whether or in the NCAA. And, you know, at the same time, too, there's reasons why players go the junior route here in Canada. And I think that that's because that's what makes them most ready to be able to jump into the professional ranks. Some of the players in Europe have the ability to step into the minors, which due to the rules that the AHL has established with the CHL, and it allows these Europeans to just walk in and be able to kind of conform to the North American lifestyle, because I think that might be one of the biggest challenges. The game itself is a little bit different, obviously, with a change in ice surface, but I just don't feel that it's a matter of skills or high-end talent. It's just a matter of conforming to the type of lifestyle that they're going to have to live here. The NCAA route is, you know, I recognize that there's a lot of decent talent there. However, they're not playing at the same type of competition that you're playing through the OHL or the Q or the Dub. And I don't feel that sometimes, they might be a little bit rushed in terms of the players that they pick out of there. Those are the guys that also have 4 years worth of eligibility, so you don't have to sign them as a team for four more years. So there's a reason why those players might end up getting picked a little bit later on in the draft. I think that what teams are looking at from a specific European perspective is how fast can they get them here, how quick can they get them in their lineup, and how quick can they adapt to this North American lifestyle. From the NCAA, they're looking at, is this player going to actually go through the 4 years of college? Are they going to go for the degree, or are they going to go for the professional hockey route? And if they are, is there another way to actually implement a quicker route to get to the NHL? You see a lot of players that jump out of the NCAA that end up going into the CHL just so they can develop their own skills a little bit further. So I'm not as familiar with most of these players, but I don't find that there's any real hidden gems or anything that'll stand out that we haven't seen probably through our viewings here at the OHL and the Q and the Dub.
Looking at Ottawa's second pick in the first round, I believe it projects to be a 21st overall pick. Are there any talents that should be available late in the round that Ottawa fans should keep an eye on?
There's actually quite a few in that range that I feel are, again, I'm going to use the word project because that's essentially what they are. But there are guys, and it kind of depends on what Ottawa's looking for, and I feel that Ottawa's really lacking up front, especially in terms of goal scoring. So they might look at guys like Lucas Lesio out of Oshawa, maybe even a Nick Jensen, some guy that brings a little bit of sandpaper. There's a bunch of players down in that range that they can that are more goal scorers, have that goal-scoring mentality. Those two, as I said, I don't have my list here in front of me, otherwise I'd be able to rattle off a few others, but Lucas Lesio is actually a very interesting proposition, and he'll be available at that point in time. Same thing with his teammate Nick Jensen, both out of Ottawa, Oshawa. And, you know, if Ottawa's looking for a little bit of goal scoring, especially with a little bit of sandpaper, those are the two players that they probably could be targeting.
So one question I had for you, is that there's a lot of stereotypes about the different characteristics of the WHL, the OHL, and the Q. The Q has a reputation for being high scoring, shoddy defense, the O for being, you know, more of a complete league, and the W for being a tough league. But that seems to be common sentiment among hockey fans. Can you maybe shed some light on this?
Actually, I think that you hit the nail on the head. That seems to be the prevailing mentality. And you know, in a way, they're kind of right. You're looking at a historical view of these teams that have been. Like, I'll give you an example with the Q. You see guys like Luc Robitaille, you know, coming out of the Q that was just not a very good skater, but the guy could score like there's nothing else. There's and we're talking 20 plus years ago, and it's still kind of the same way today. You know, they're. And that's probably why they're developing such a great goaltending faculty out of there. It's because these guys face so many shots and scoring chances, and it's almost as if they've seen it all before they even hit the pro levels. So it's not necessarily a negative stereotype. I think that that's actually pretty accurate. I think that's what you get. You get less in defense out in the Q. You get a very complete game in the O, and you know, there's a lot of travel involved, and there's a lot of Western boys that, you know, have grown up in a bit of a harsher lifestyle, or not harsher, but a more physically demanding lifestyle. So it translates onto the ice. when you got guys coming out of the O, you see that they're coming out of some of the major city centers, out of Toronto, the GTHL, some of the other more urban rather than rural areas, so that they're a little bit less, I don't want to use say less tough, but that mental toughness might not necessarily be as prevalent as in from the boys in the dub. And you know, there are some monsters out there in the dub. They really do have to kind of keep their head up. So you're looking at it from the historical perspective of, yeah, this is what this league is known for. So players knowing going into that league, they're gearing up for it too. So it kind of furthers that stereotype as well. Even guys like out in the queue, you know that they're swift, they're fast, they can score, great vision, good shooting, et cetera, et cetera. And that doesn't seem to change. So I think that those stereotypes are actually quite valid. And, you know, you could see it in reflections in the players as soon as they get out of those leagues and what they actually do end up bringing to the pros, that they tend to bring those type of characteristics along with them.
It's an interesting discussion. With the 21st selection, is there a player, like you mentioned Jensen and his teammate Lesio, is there anyone else who you'd consider maybe reaching for and trading that 21st pick to move up to select someone?
I wouldn't actually think that there would be a lot of players that you'd want to trade up for. There are a lot of good little... Let's put it into another. Ottawa right now is desperate for goals. I think that's what their main objective is. So those two players that I mentioned before, Jensen and Lesio, those are the goal scorers. But you have guys like Shane Prince, who's familiar. You ought to be familiar with him coming from the 67s.
Oh, yeah.
Even a guy as you know, a big, rangy kind of player like Mark Shifley out of Barrie, even Boone Jenner, still a lot of Oshawa, you know, Brandon Saad from Saginaw. And again, I'm focusing more from the CHL because these are the players that I want to see a little bit more. But any of those guys are able to just be a productive player, will end up becoming a productive player at some point in time. It's just a matter of tweaking some of their skills. So even a guy like Matthew Pumple, who played in a horrible Peterborough team, but you could see that he has a skill set that's above and beyond his own peers. So it's just a matter of a little bit of development. The one player Ottawa might look at just from the goal-scoring perspective would be Tyler Biggs. Tyler Biggs coming out of the U.S., be under the National Development Program. He's a player that's very interesting, and you know, he's able to step up into those big game situations. So Ottawa might look at him and say, you know, we need someone that's going to eventually be a game breaker, and this guy has the potential to do that. Daniel Alfredson's not going to be around as much anymore, and you know, Spezza, but they're looking for game breakers, and this guy does have that potential to do that. It's just a matter of developing into the characteristics into becoming that game breaker. And, you know, all those players that we've just discussed right now, especially after the midterm mark of the first round, are all projects. So you don't really know what you're getting until you've actually developed the skills that you've seen over and over and over again from your scouting staff. So I think that's essentially the list of what Ottawa is probably going to be looking at in that 21st pick.
Well, Brian Murray's had a little bit of success in Anaheim, drafting some forwards mid-round who've gone on to score quite a number of goals, and Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaff. So hopefully he'll be able to strike gold once again here in Ottawa.
Well, you know, Brian Murray actually has a long laundry list of players that he's drafted. And I was given, I have a friend who is an Ottawa fan, and he gave me a list of a whole bunch of players, guys like Keith Primo. Did you know that he actually drafted a Brian Lee in the 2002 in Anaheim, 71st overall in the third round?
I was not aware.
Yeah, so maybe that's why he's given Brian Lee so much of a long rope. Actually, Brian Lee, I have to say, has been one of those remarkable turnaround stories. He was just horrible at the beginning of the season, just didn't seem to fit in anywhere. And by the end of the season, he's playing top 6 minutes and being quite effective. Who knows? Maybe that connection to his own drafting of a Brian Lee kind of gave him the opportunity to say, all right, let's give this kid the opportunity to develop into an NHL player too. But you go back through his entire session, and you know, he drafted Philip Kuba. You know, so back in the day, 1995, and out of Florida in the eighth round. So, You know, Murray's been able, and by Murray, I say Murray and the people that he surrounds himself with, because you can't do anything as a GM without a fantastic scouting and development staff. He surrounded himself with those pretty good people, so they're able to find these kind of little gems that not necessarily will have, you know, big star potential, but they're going to be players, and that's essentially what you're looking at. You have to stock every single line, your first, second, third, and fourth line, and all defensive pairings, and then also include some of your AHL players as well. Just drafting a player out of the sixth round that ends up playing, you know, four or five seasons for your AHL affiliate, you know, that's a pretty successful draft pick if you ask me. Playing in the pros is not guaranteed, and it's not an easy turnaround as well. So any player that ends up playing for your organization in some form or capacity is pretty good drafting and development in my eyes.
Yeah, as we talk about Brian Lee, one name that instantly jumps to mind as being not a surefire NHLer is Jim O'Brien, who's actually looked fantastic playing in Bingo this year and seems to have made quite the turnaround. And I guess he's another great Murray pickup.
And he was another one that was kind of picked up, you know, in the lower part of the first round, had flaws in his game, but he's obviously developed them. But, you know, he's also one of those players that seems to be a bit of a late bloomer, too. You know, everything that he's done seems to come in the later stages of his career. Same from junior. All of a sudden, you know, he's turning it around as a pro. And I've watched Jim O'Brien pretty intensely since he's become, since Ottawa drafted him. And you could see that curve that he's starting on and he's just progressing and getting bigger and stronger and faster and smarter with the puck and being a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more assertive. And you know, that it's baby steps, but, you know, if that's what it takes to become a professional hockey player, so be it. And, you know, Bingo's having a nice little run in the Calder Cup playoffs as well, something I never would have pictured. Although, you know, and just on that note, too, just having the foresight to pick up a guy like Ryan Patolny, realizing that he would be a fantastic addition to your Binghamton Senators rather than the Ottawa Senators, totally made sense for when they were making the deal out for Chris Campoli. I think it was for Chris Campoli that they picked him up.
Yep, it
I
was.
Can't recall. Yeah, so that's foresight. You need to stock every single spot on your NHL and minor league affiliate roster. And Murray isn't as he's pretty good in terms of assessing talent. Now it's just a matter of developing that talent to the NHL level.
All right, now Gus, here's the million-dollar question. I'm gonna ask you right now, with the sixth pick, who do you think Ottawa will be drafting? If you have to think about how it's gonna shake down.
Can I give you two picks, or is it just one?
Go ahead.
About two picks. I think that's reasonable.
Two is fine.
Okay, it'll be either one of Sean Couturier, if he gets past the Devils, that is, because I think that he really fits in with the Devils. Or Jonathan Huberdeau. I think it's going to be one of those two. They're both pivots. They're both offensively, you know, off the charts. They're dynamic. They do everything that the Sens are looking for. Couturier is a little bit more defensively mature. Huberdeau is a little bit better in terms of a total overall game. So either of those two players, I think, are what's probably being circled in a whiteboard, because they just probably won't be able to get into a guy like, you know, I just don't feel that Landeskog is going to be there, and I don't think that they're going to target a defenseman, regardless of how good they are. So I think that it's going to be either Huberdeau or Couturier.
Well, Gus, you know what? It's been absolutely fantastic talking to someone who's actually seen these kids play and who has an educated opinion on them. I find all too often people get caught up in fancy written scouting reports on the internet and take them for gospel. So it's great to hear someone who's actually seen these person in real life and knows what to expect and to temper our expectations a little bit, I guess. What do we have to look forward to from McKeon's in the future?
Every year that we do, we do a fantasy magazine, which is available in August. It is pretty detailed, and it involves every single team, and it's individual scouting reports on 17 players, including four prospects from every single club. We usually do a draft preview as well. This year, because of we're going through a little bit of an overture and some changes within the organization, we're not going to be publishing a draft guide. We just didn't feel that we'd be able to give you the best information in a timely manner. So rather than put out a product that is just subpar, we'd rather not do it and face the consequences that way. But we'll be back, and I'm working on, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that too, because I just finished doing the Leafs, and I'm going to be jumping on to write up the Ottawa Senators within the next couple of days. So that's what you can look forward to for McKeon's.
Awesome.
Oh, all right.
Thanks, Gus.
Thanks a lot, Gus.
Absolutely, not a problem. Fantastic having you on.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I had a lot of fun. It's great. Go Sens. Tension grows, the whistle blows, the puck goes down the ice. The goalie jumps, the players bump, the fans all go insane. Summer roars, Johnny scores, the good old hockey game.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are currently joined by Joe Keithley of Canadian punk rock band DOA, Legends in Canada. Keith Morris has called them the greatest punk band of all time and the greatest live show he's ever seen. Henry Rollins says that you're a great band and also great friends. That's a nice sentiment. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I didn't know Keith had said that, but that's very nice of him, right?
Yeah, I'll have to.
And Henry Rollins is a really cool guy, so... yeah, and very generous with his comments, right?
Absolutely. Maybe a little bit too well-researched, but we'll take it.
No, that's okay. It's good to know what you're talking about, right? So I run into an awful lot of people in this world that don't.
All right, off the bat, what are your thoughts on the playoffs so far?
Well, I'm really surprised, and that means I'm really nowhere close to my hockey pool. Like, it was, I usually try and base my hockey pool in, like, on the four teams, I think I'll get to the conference final. And if you got most of your guys left, then you have a 75% chance of winning the pool, right? So even if your particular guys don't win the cup, you know what I mean, right? So, hey, I picked the Bruins, Capitals in the East, and the Sharks, Canucks in the West, but I didn't get enough decent Canucks, so I'm out of it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had the opportunity to pick a playoff pool for myself and my co-host Graham here, and the team I picked for myself is just near the bottom right now, 294th, and it's a money pool, and the one I picked for him is actually in first place right now, so a little bit of egg on my face, a little bit of money soon to be in his wallet.
There you go. He was going to owe you a few beers, right? So it's not a bad thing, right?
Absolutely, that's the deal. So right now, the Canucks are obviously, reaching fever heights in BC.
They have been all year. It's unbelievable, like, if you consider the way they were, like, 10 years ago compared to now. It's especially at a fever pitch today. I mean, everybody's just sitting there waiting, like, killing time till the game starts, basically.
Yeah, do you remember what it was like in Vancouver and BC in 1994 when they were playing the Rangers in the finals?
I do. I was actually in Europe most of the time. So in those days, because there was no internet, or internet was just starting, and so what we would do before we'd settle on the highway to the next show, we would go to the central train station, whether it be like in whatever town in Italy, Germany, or France. And we'd have to go get, it was called the Tribune. It was the one English language daily you could get. And we'd get the score. So we saw they were advancing, right? So it was very exciting. And we got back and just in time for the seven-game final against the Rangers. It was a fever pitch, and there ended up being, a big riot on Robson Street, unfortunately. I think we could have been cast as the town of sore losers after that happened, right? I think you're supposed to riot when you win, not when you lose, right? So.
Yeah, it's kind of a Montreal-specific thing to do, I've always thought.
Yeah, well, I equate it kind of to, Detroit Pistons. That was really rough when they won the championship back there a couple times, I think 91 and 92. They finally knocked out the Lakers. People go with guns, and I think about 8-9 people died. It was horrible, right? And Chicago was pretty bad when the Bulls had their runs with Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and all that, right? So things got pretty rough.
All right, so speaking of things getting rough, I got a question here for you. So in punk rock, there's kind of been, a little bit of history of hockey reference. You've got bands like Slapshot from Boston, the Hanson Brothers from BC, yourselves, Propagandy, the Misfits, Dropkick Murphys, bands like this who are all huge hockey fans.
Right.
A little bit baffling to me, but, what is it about hockey that lends itself so well to the punk rock ideology or the message?
Yeah, it's kind of the rough and tumble, and it's also the fact is that it's not I think that is not – it's become more corporate as time has gone on, but it was not a big thing like Major League Baseball or basketball or football. It's a bit more of an underground feel to it in a way. I mean, not anymore. It's totally corporatized, the NHL is, right? But, 10, 15 years ago when a lot of these bands got into this hockey thing, I think they would equate it. And also the rough and tumble and the and a band, you're sort of like, if you're the lead singer, you're the center, and you have a guitar player and a bass player, they're the wingers, and the drummer's the goalie. So it's kind of like it's you versus the audience, right? That's the opposing team.
So, like, one of the obvious paradoxes to this discussion is, you know, kind of the history and, you know, maybe not, you know, athletes or jocks, whatever you want to call them. It's just semantics, I guess. And between punk rockers, you know, like the 7 Seconds song, I Hate Sports.
I hate sports.
There you go. Obvious one that comes to mind. Like, how does this happen?
And the Jello Biafra had was Jockarama, the Dead Kennedy. And it had that line in the middle that the band slows down. And he goes, "The star quarterback is lying on the field with a broken neck. What a hero. What a man." You know, so it was really funny because Biafra did that. And then he was up in Vancouver when the 94 run for the Canucks was going on. And he actually got into it. Like, he was just going, he was staying at some friend's house. And big parties were going on every time the Canucks played. And he was like, "This isn't bad." You know what I mean? Right? So, and now the guy who wrote that I Hate Sports, Tommy Borghino, the original drummer for 7 Seconds, that guy goes to every single Oakland Raiders game there is, right? And I've been to Oakland Athletics games with him and Raiders games, and he's a Sharks. You know what I mean, right? After a while, it all comes around, so you kind of realize, hey, I actually do like this stuff. But I think coming out of high school, that a lot of people had bad experiences with jocks, you know, that thought they were better than other people. And those days probably really looked down, not probably, but did look down on punk rockers. So I think that's where that comes from.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that makes sense. I remember going to see AAA baseball here in Ottawa a number of years ago when I was a kid, and Scott Rudinsky, who was the lead singer in 10-Foot Pole and Pulley.
Yeah, I know Scott. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, there he is, you know, only a few steps away from the major league. So I always thought that was pretty cool. We had a good talk with him that day.
Yeah, it was pretty good. We played in Toronto one time. It was a secret show. We played at the Elmo Combo. It was like one Sunday night Fallen Elvis show or something like that. And Jason Smith, he used to be the captain of the Oilers, and I think he's fallen in some rough times now. But Felix Potvin showed up, and Felix was like a ex-Toronto goalie, was a big-time punk rock fan and stuff like that, and they came and hung out and wanted to meet DOA, and they, you know, it was cool.
Yeah, they always managed to turn up. So, like, surely after all the years on the road and you know, all your time in DOA, you must have some good experiences with hockey and either bands you've toured with or you know, playing at arenas or something like that. Do you have anything to share?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had some real fun impromptu hockey games, like, because usually the van has a bunch of sticks, so we usually try to work up some sort of ball hockey game if we have enough time, right? And there's always competition because DOA's got a rep for playing hockey, ice hockey or ball hockey. So, you know, it's only 4 of us, and then 12 guys will show up. Like, we got a game organized, you know. Like, you aren't going to win a game against 12 guys. You're just going to get run ragged, right? So, challengers are always there.
It reminds me of that Jay and Silent Bob video with Soul Asylum when they're running around in the parking lot playing hockey. Have you seen that one?
Years ago. I just heard Soul Asylum's name today. I hadn't heard about them in years. They're playing some festival in like a little town in BC, right? And they played that one big song. But I do remember he had a weird thing. I read an interview because I was quite interested in the hockey rock thing. And he's going, "Oh, yeah, the left winger is the most important guy on the team." And I'm going, like, okay. But I think that was about the time when the Red Wings instituted the left wing lock defensive system, which, you know, pretty well every team took their turn at copying, right? So, but it's just a weird statement because it's obviously the goalie or the your center ice men are usually the most important guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So speaking of important guys, important things here, you know, DOA obviously is a very, very important Canadian band, you know, and I find a lot of your music really deals in kind of universal language and universal issues. And the songs that you wrote, excuse my math here, like, you know, going on 30 years ago, are just as relevant today. But the one thing I can never get over is that your band just seems to ooze Canadiana despite, you know, all these universal, you know, content. you know, and you do a really good job, it seems, maybe inadvertently, of exploring the Canadian experience. Is this something that was done consciously, or is this just a
project? Yeah, it pretty well was, because, I mean, I thought back in, you know, way back when DOA started, like 30 years ago, that to me, you know, having an identity where you're from was really important. So, you know, to me, you know, when you thought of Texas, you thought of ZZ Top. When you thought of London, you thought of the Sex Pistols. When you thought of New York, you thought of the New York Dolls. And Detroit, you thought of Iggy Pop and the MC5. You know what I mean? So it was something really identifiable about their identity, and kind of also partly the way they looked. And then we kind of came up with the whole sort of Mac jacket or the flannel type thing as the lumberman. I mean, we wore them all the time, and then we kind of realized, like, hey, this would be pretty good on stage. And then there's the conscious decision, like, to put hockey into the discussion. And then, of course, Canadian politics, too, right? So, like, in, you know, fucked up things in Canada. It's like it's where we live, so it's good to address those issues.
Oh, absolutely. So, currently you're running Sudden Death Records.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Very nice hockey-inspired name there. Can you tell us about, you know, the origin of the name and some of the bands that you've put out?
Yeah, originally we thought about the Sudden Death came about because we didn't have a label, so we wanted to put out our first record, which was the Disco Sucks 7-inch EP. And what we did, we thought, okay, the name of the band is DOA, okay, let's make a label. So I said, okay, how about Sudden Death? But then later, obviously, it just kind of fell into, obviously, being like Sudden Death Overtime tied in with the hockey angle, right? So... But the bands we put out, when Sudden Death got really serious in 1998, like a real label, because previously we just put out singles and stuff like that, and it wasn't that very serious at all. Since then, we put out like a lot of older bands from Vancouver, some reissues that have been really great, like the Young Canadians, the Modernettes, the Pointed Sticks. There's another great album called The Vancouver Complication, which is a comp of all the bands in Van back in 79. And then, you know, of course, we've done pretty well with, like, the Real McKenzies. We put out a couple of their records.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that the Point of Sticks reissues that you put out are among my favorites I've heard over the past 5 years. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, great records, for sure. They're a really good band, and they have a really good following in Japan and down up and down the West Coast. And they get invited to, like, festivals and stuff like that. So it's kind of having the albums out again has kind of revitalized their career, so it's kind of fun. They do play once in a while. It's neat.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool that some of these bands that at one point maybe had a sound that was, you know, really relevant to the time but might have even been ahead of their time a little bit.
Yeah.
And now with the rise and popularity of, you know, all these different combinations of music, you know, everything from, you know, power pop to punk rock, and it's so readily available these days that it's kind of rejuvenating these careers, and these bands are able to to start playing shows again and to appeal to a whole new audience and get some of the just deserves that they've earned.
Yeah, I think so, because you get people that, and what you do is you get people that are the age of the bands, you know, like people in their 50s or whatever, or late 40s, and but you open up to a whole new bunch of people that could be in their 20s and 30s, right? So yeah, I definitely I mean, there's just whatever type of music there is in this world, there's an audience for it. It just depends how big it is, right? So, and obviously, any type of music that is out there now had to start from somewhere. So it's always good to look back on the original source of some of this stuff.
Oh, definitely. So I don't want to eat up too much of your time here, but I got a few quick hit questions for you, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
All right. Sure. Best current Canadian band?
Oh, don't know. Still looking.
Favorite past band to play with?
Either Black Flag or No Means No.
Okay.
They're always interesting, and it was always different.
I could imagine Black Flag was always interesting.
Yeah, Black Flag was always really interesting. Right? So,
favorite food on the road?
Oh, my God. Mexican food. When I get down to California, we usually have a contest.
Sounds like no.
You can meet Mexican food every single day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Sounds like the fun's happened after the winner's been nominated.
Exactly.
Favorite band that Chuck Biscuits has been in?
I think he was the most creative in DOA because he didn't get slowed down. Like, he was good with the Jerks.
Yeah.
I mean, he was excellent, like, in every band he was in. But with DOA, he was, like, a wild man, because if we didn't know what to do, me and Randy would just go like, what would Keith Moon do?
Yep.
And he kind of incorporated that into his style.
Put the machine gun on automatic, I guess.
These incredibly quick rolls, right? So,
if you were in charge of music at an NHL game, what would be the song to play after a goal is scored?
Oh, okay, yeah, good point, because they do play some real crap music at a lot of the arenas.
Absolutely.
Well, it wouldn't be Gary Glitter's song, I'd tell you that much, right? So,
yeah.
I don't know, I was just listening to one, Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, only if it was a Saturday night game.
Hopefully, I don't know, the Elton John version?
Yeah, that's the only decent one I've heard.
All right, and the Green Men in Vancouver, yay or nay?
I'm not a fan. But you know what? I don't think the NHL, the more they talk about it, they just give more publicity. I think they're totally annoying. And one of these days, a guy in the penalty box is going to reach up over and just pop one of these guys in the head. You know what? And usually guys in the NHL know how to punch.
Yep. It sounds like ratings improve one way or the other. So maybe
so
good for the Goose.
They're going to get it one way or the other. Like some guy's just going to lose it, right? So.
Amen. All right. So what are you up to these days? Do you have anything on your plate that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, actually interesting. I'm glad you asked. This coming out now, June 1st, I have a new book out. It's called Talk Minus Action Equals Zero. And it's an illustrated history of DOA. So you get like... flyers and posters and pictures and all the stuff that goes through the entire DOA history, but there's a lot of text with it. So as you go through, you look through all these illustrations or posters or pictures, there's a story that goes with it, why we used it or what happened here. So it's pretty interesting. I've got an advanced copy sitting in front of me, and it's out in stores in 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, as someone who's read I, Shithead, you know, fantastic contribution to the literature pertaining to Canadian punk rock, and definitely necessary and long overdue. And
yeah, well, that's why they call me the Hemingway of hemorrhoids.
Beautiful. Love it. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Joe.
No, my pleasure. Have a great afternoon, and go Canucks, go.
Wish you all the best on Robson. Enjoy the time.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Okay.
We'll be right back.